problem is the twin wavelength is already far, far afield. And you made the statement that cylindrical wave exists only in near field. So my interest is what's happening is when we increase the distance to the end of the near field, will the amplitude, if we, let me stop, if we make a withdrawal on the paper line source and then cylinders around that, could we make the drawing in such a way that each consequent cylinder far from the line source has is smaller and smaller and smaller till the end of the line source? And 20 wavelengths is already far field. And to achieve.
When you're real close to a line source, the E field may look like it is linear, and the H field will look like it's cylindrical. But that cylindrical function, when you're real close, starts becoming a larger and larger radius cylinder. By the time you're 10 wavelengths away, it is so close to a planar wave, TEM, that it will be very difficult for you to resolve the difference. So no matter what the source is, at any substantial difference where you really intend to communicate with real radio at a real distance, a fraction of a mile, so to speak, it's going to be a TEM wave. That's the only thing that really propagates. The cylindrical function up close looks nice, and you may find a zillion website articles where people talk about cylindrical waves, and maybe they believe they propagate into space. I do not believe it. WS, K2LIW.
Yeah, just a few more questions, and I let you go to Dr. Roy. So you say that the more far away from the line source we are, the E field, that means the height of drawn on the paper cylinder, is higher, not smaller. But at the same time, you said that cylindrical wave exists only in near field. So I'm confused there. Enter a shift.
Even if you're only one wavelength away from a cylindrical source, with the right kind of equipment, you'll measure some number of volts per meter of E field and some number of amps per meter of H field. And even one wavelength away from that line source, the two will be related very close to the 377 ohms of free space. So you may think that a mile-long line source is making an E field where the vector is a mile long. Absolutely not. It's got some number, finite number of volts per meter of E field and amps per meter of H field. And even one wavelength away, that ratio is going to be very close to 377. Over to US, K2LIW.
And now polarization. Maxwell equations, we find that transverse wave both in E and B vectors are perpendicular to the direction of propagation of the radiation. So even Maxwell and Tom and Young inferred that transverse character of the wave, it's light as well. My question is, what impact polarization could have on the TEM wave, and could we achieve TM mode from that at HCM in the interface?
Absolutely not. The E field, polarization is usually aligned with the E field. If my line source happens to be a horizontal piece of wire, then it is by definition transmitting horizontal E field, horizontal polarization. H field will be vertical. There's another point I was going to make about that. I forget what it was. I'll turn it back to you, K2LIW.
If you wire or your cylindrical antenna that creates cylindrical waves, it has vertical polarization. And then you have, and it's directly above the interface, and the interface is right below. There are significant numbers of publications standing about changing the TEM to work in TEM mode in that interface, and that is done by polarization of cylindrical wave and to XGM.
You cannot generate a TEM wave in free space. Inside of a waveguide, you can. The reason why you can get a TEM wave in a waveguide is that you really have a pair of TEM waves going down that waveguide in a zigzag manner. If you plot the direction of propagation of the left-hand and the right-hand TEM wave, it looks like the length of a pair of scissors, so to speak, and the scissors open up at a particular angle. There's a particular angle between those two waves going down a piece of waveguide. In the normal manner of with a piece of waveguide, with the broad wall parallel to the table, the two waves are zigzagging left and right by bouncing off the narrow walls. Because they are going down the waveguide at a zigzag angle, the horizontal H field has a component in the direction of propagation. That's why it's called a TEM wave. There is a component of the H field in the magnetic field in the direction of propagation. Because there is a pair of waves bouncing back and forth in the waveguide, you cannot generate a TEM wave in free space. It takes the multiple reflections inside of a piece of waveguide to do it. It doesn't exist in real propagation in real space. You may come up with fancy mathematics, and an inch away from the antenna, you may think you see a TEM wave. That's not what's really propagating. In free space, it will not do that. OWS, K2RIW.
But the most familiar type of polarization is linear polarization. So we have E vector that oscillates at the same plane at all points of wave. And the state of linear polarization can be expressed by linear sum of orthogonal states, XY. But linearly polarized radiation oscillates in the same plane at all times and all points in space. So we have EX or EY. They are in phase to that linearly polarized object, as was this transverse wave, not object. So both components have a zero crossing at the same point in time in space. So that means that polarization alters TEM or not into XGM.
There may be a language barrier. I'm not sure you're asking a question, and I don't know what the question is.
Well, the question is impact of polarization on TEM.
Impact of what on TEM?
Of polarization. So, what polarization does with TEM?
Whatever the direction of your E field is, that is the polarization. If the E field is vertical, in far space, free space, far field propagation, then that is by definition a E field a vertically polarized wave, and it will have a magnetic component in each field that's exactly at right angles, which will be horizontal. That's for linear polarization, and for elliptical and circular, it changes as a function of time at the wavelength rate. But still, at each instant of time, E and H are always exactly at right angles to each other at a particular ratio that matches 377 ohms. OWS, K2RIW.
And we could choose whether our B field is vertical or horizontal, as well as our electric field. And to XGM.
When you choose one, you have automatically chosen the other. If I choose the E field to be vertical, then the H field will be horizontal. There is no other choice. choose one, and you have automatically chosen the other.
I do thank you very much for the answers. Would you mind if next week I prepare a set of questions about the interface, which for some appears to be XY only, the propagation of magnetic field and what happened to the electrical field, unless you have a time to say a few words now.
My antenna itself may be, say, for instance, a very small diameter loop, and we call it a magnetic loop antenna. And the majority of what emits in the first inch of operation is a magnetic field. But that oscillating magnetic field, when interfacing the 377 ohms of free space, will create a quantifiable amount of E-field. So when I'm away from that magnetic, when I'm using an antenna that I think is purely magnetic, it's a solenoid coil, or it's a tenth of a wavelength circumference coil that I'm resonating and forcing it to radiate a magnetic field. When I get a few wavelengths away from that, there will be an H-field. The process of generating the oscillating magnetic field forces a oscillating E-field to be created. That's the way Mother Nature behaves. How she does it, I don't know. I've done enough experiments to know she does do it extremely reliably, extremely predictably, in both polarization and magnitude, and signal strength versus distance and weather, inverse square law for actually power flux density, and inverse linear law when it comes to E-field and H-field. She does that. So you cannot generate a oscillating magnetic field which is detectable at a far field without there being a corresponding E-field of predictable magnitude and predictable polarization. That's the only thing that will propagate. You generate one, you are generating the other. Right now, it's a bit difficult for me to envision an antenna that generates only E-field and no H-field. I presume it exists, but almost all of the antenna analyzing programs that you and I can get a hold of, by finite element, divides the antenna into a small number of little pieces, carefully calculates the current flowing into each one of those pieces. From that, they calculate the amount of magnetic field generated by each one of those pieces. And that, in turn, creates the propagation that gets analyzed. That's the way most antenna analyzing programs work. It appears to me that the real magic is the magnetic field generation in almost any antenna. And where the H field comes from, I don't know, but it is there, extremely predictably, always there, with a predictable polarization and predictable magnitude. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Bravo, Zulu.
Thank you very much. The gentleman will pick up.
Bravo Zulu, you got it.
Dick, before turning it over to Dr. Roy, who's been very helpful to me personally, I have two quick questions on magnetic loop. Well, one's on magnetic loop, and one is about the curve of an SWR plot. The first one on magnetic loops is, I read a comment, somebody said that, forget your antenna tuner when you're using magnetic loops. Do you agree with that, and if so, why?
An antenna tuner that has enough dynamic range to it can impedance match anything that you and I call antenna. If I've got enough dynamic range, enough variability in the L's and C's of my antenna tuner, I cannot generate an antenna that cannot be impedance matched. It's just strictly a function of magnetic, dynamic range. My particular antenna, with extremely poor engineering, might have a resistive impedance of 0.1 ohm and a reactive impedance of 10,000 ohms. That's about as bad as you can get. That's a standing wave ratio of about 10,000 to 1. If I've got a large enough dynamic range, tunable range to my antenna tuner, I can give you a perfect impedance match to that. If you don't believe it, go to that Berkeley program. You Google the word Berkeley and impedance match, and you tell it whatever impedance that you can envision, no matter how wild it is. You tell Berkeley that my resistive component of my antenna is 0.01 ohm, and my reactive component is 1,000 ohms, and Berkeley, please design an impedance matching filter, an LC network, between the two. you press go, and in 1 second you've got 15 solutions for that particular problem, and they will really work. Bravo Zulu, KQRIW.
Okay, of course it depends on how good a tuner. How do you quantify how good a tuner is? Go ahead, Dick.
I wish antenna tuner manufacturers would give you a Smith chart, and certain portions of the Smith chart would be colored in. And they would tell you on the 10-meter band, these are the areas of the Smith chart where this antenna tuner will give you a perfect impedance match. And another Smith chart for the 20-meter band. That would be the way that they could give you the most amount of information, megabytes of data, in a very small amount of bits of display. If they were smart enough, that's the way they would do it. You take, for instance, the ATC company that makes some very high-quality ceramic capacitors. They were rating the quality of their capacitors with a Smith chart, and they were dead on. They were correct. Antenna tuner manufacturers, if they were smart enough, they would give you the information in that manner. And then you know that the dot that represents the impedance of your antenna placed on that Smith chart, if it's inside the colored area, you're home free. If it's outside of the colored area, you're going to have to do something extra before you can use your antenna tuner. There's ways you can take the wildest antenna in the world that's outside of the colored area of that Smith chart by adding an extra reactor, a loading coil, a loading capacitor, an LC network or whatever, and the right length of transmission line. You can force your crazy antenna to fall within the active region of your antenna tuner. So the fact that your antenna tuner doesn't work immediately doesn't mean it's game over. Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
Okay, so whether I have a dipole in free space or a magnetic loop, like I do, I have a large magnetic loop that's 17 feet in diameter for 40 and 80 and 20. If I'm hearing with my antenna tuner an increase as I'm turning the coil, an increase in background noise, a good increase in background noise, that means that that antenna tuner is helping with this magnetic loop. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Not only helping, but it's probably coming pretty close to a good solution. In order for your noise at the background to increase that substantially, you're probably coming under a 2-to-1 overall standing wave ratio when you do that. And by way of using an antenna analyzer, or by way of transmitting into that network with your Bird wattmeter, and you look at the forward power and reverse power, there's ways you can find out exactly how good a match you're getting. Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
To Bravo Zulu, K2RIW, and the TechNet. But there are no specs. If I went out, which I'm not going to, I have an NFJ, I think it's a 969. There are no specs, are there, of antenna tuners that you can tell which one is better than the other?
Because the whole impedance matching problem is so darn complicated with complex mathematics, real and imaginary numbers, and so few amateurs really understand it, the manufacturers of antenna tuners are afraid to give you exact info. At times they will tell you that this antenna tuner on the 10-meter band will match any impedance that's under a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio. Or on the 80-meter band, it'll match anything under a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio. They'll tell you that. In reality, it can do a hell of a lot more than that. They may tell you on the 10-meter band it can only match up to any possible impedance of a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio. For certain particular impedances, it may be able to match a 15-to-1, not at all possible phase angles. But if they tell you it'll match anything under 5-to-1, you've got it made. So that's a way you can get a little bit of quantitative information. Other than that, you'll have to dig into, by various techniques, you can find out what is the number of picofarads of the C1 variable capacitor and the C2 variable capacitor, what's the number of microhenries of the inductor and its taps. Once you get that information, there are ways you can calculate what's the maximum standing wave ratio it will match for each of your bands. So once you find out the component values and you're smart enough, you can derive the information that they never gave you. Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
Just true of me doing an SWR plot with my antenna analyzer into this magnetic loop. It happened when I was trying to when I was fooling around, if you remember, with my screwdriver antenna, that the plot isn't like a smooth curve upward or downward. It doesn't matter. The plot is more spiky, and the spikes, let's say on 80 meters, this particular magnetic loop was spiking up and down, but all below 1.5 to 1. But then all of a sudden, you know, it spikes up way above 8.1 to 1 and comes down again, then gets spiky again, then spikes all the way, spiky again, but below, let's say, 2 to 1. But then it spikes all the way above 1 and like that. In other words, it's not a smooth graph. It's a very spiky graph. Some below 2 to 1, some way above.
I don't think the antenna can really do that. I think you're looking at idiosyncrasies of your particular antenna analyzer. For a 80-meter antenna to have that many spikes close in frequency, it doesn't have the resources to do that. I think you're looking at an idiosyncrasy of your particular antenna analyzer. Over to you, Bravo Zulu.
That same antenna analyzer, when measuring VHF, does give me smooth curves. So what would you say to that?
I think your antenna analyzer is lying to you. I think you're using it at power levels and at frequencies where the diodes that are in there doing the detecting are saturating getting into voltage breakdown. Your antenna doesn't have the resources to do that. If you run the antenna analyzer at a lower power level, do you still get the same number of spikes?
This is without loads into the analyzer. This was, I don't even know how I would run this this antenna analyzer. This is a USB antenna. It plugs into my computer, and then the feed line screws into the 259. So how would I put a load on this?
By way of putting with T connectors 50-ohm resistors and 50-ohm terminations, two of them in parallel, or with T connectors you can put four of them in parallel, you can create a known resistive standing wave ratio with various lengths of transmission lines from that composite load into your analyzer. You can now simulate any amount of reactive impedance at that visual you want to. So four 50-ohm terminations by way of T connectors, all in parallel, is by definition a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio. If you put a quarter wavelength of transmission line between it and your antenna analyzer, you're now making a 2 and 50 would be 25, 12.5. You're 12.5 ohms of resistance right at the T connector with a quarter wavelength of transmission line will become a 200 ohm resistor, so to speak. By various lengths of transmission line, you can now create every possible 4-to-1 standing wave ratio on that Smith chart. So you can make a test setup like that and find out what your antenna analyzer is indicating. Your test setup, if you did this on 80 meters, for instance, the test setup would be nearly perfect. Really perfect in predicting what the real standing wave ratio is for every length of transmission line. If your antenna analyzer did not give you those numbers, then you know it's lying to you. So there's ways you can test your antenna analyzer without spending a fortune. Bravo Zulu, K2LIW.
What if I put a 4-to-1 Baron, commercially made 4-to-1 Baron, in between the analyzer and the line?
Every balun has got some reactive impedance left over and leakage reactants and whatever. It's not as pure. By way of pure 50-ohm dummy loads put together with T connectors, with various lengths of transmission line between it and the analyzer, you now have a pure constant 4-to-1 of various phase angles as you change the length of the transmission line. If your analyzer fails that test, you know where to start looking right away. Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
So this analyzer allows me to run a test with an open line, a shorted, and a non-shorted line. Do those get me closer to what I need?
those are necessary but not sufficient conditions. Your antenna analyzer may give the right answer with an open circuit, a short circuit, and a 50 ohm. It doesn't mean it's going to give you the right answers for all possible lengths of transmission line on a 4-to-1 made out of pure 50 ohm dummy loads. Over to you, Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
To Bravo Zulu. Last question. What is an analyzer doing when you calibrate it?
Every vector network analyzer, every standing wave ratio bridge, every antenna analyzer is transmitting a signal into the unknown load, looking at the magnitude of the reflection and the phase angle of the reflection. If the system can properly measure the amplitude and phase angle accurately, it has the correct answer. If either one of those is the wrong ratio, it's going to lie to you. So it's got to be able to measure reflection coefficient and reflection phase angle, both of them with accuracy. Over to you, K2RIW.
Okay. Would I need to run the calibration routine and software in this thing that every time I run a plot or every time I change type of antenna I'm analyzing?
The example I gave of four 50 ohm loads with T connectors put together through various length transmission lines, as long as you're using the transmission line at a frequency where the insertion loss is low enough, that is exactly a 4.000 standing wave ratio across all possible frequencies. That should be the flattest curve in the world. If your antenna analyzer with that resistive network, with a good piece of transmission line connected to it, if your antenna analyzer does not give a flat 4-to-1 curve, then it is lying to you. Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
Now, it's a dummy load for an antenna analyzer. This also allows you, the software allows you to have no effect of the line, have the line calculated or have the line definitely not calculated. There are three choices, and I'm a little confused about no effect and or calculated or not calculated. It would seem like it should be an on-off, effect or not effect. Could you explain that? I probably am not asking it correctly. Go ahead, Dick.
If the antenna analyzer, no matter what transmission line is, no matter what load is on the end of it, if the antenna analyzer can properly measure amplitude of reflected signal and phase angle of reflected signal, if it can measure those two parameters accurately, it has the correct answer. And if it properly calculates that ratio, it knows the exact standing wave ratio, it knows exactly where the point is on the slip chart, it knows exactly what the resistive component and what the reactive component of the load appears to be. So an antenna analyzer must accurately measure reflection coefficient and phase angle. That's the bedrock. That's where it all begins. It's got to be able to do that, but you've got nothing. Oh, you, Bravo Zulu, take your eyes a bit.
Those resistors with the T connectors, and see what this analyzer if it's dead on like you say it should be or not, or if I have problems with it. What this is the board, the circuit board inside one of their handheld analyzers that you connect through the serial port on a computer rather than it being handheld. However, I can turn this all into Bluetooth, which would get me closer to their handheld. The difference was like $200, and I think it's operator error on my part more than this analyzer. Thanks, Dick. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Yeah, Rich, two or four dummy loads with T-connectors and various lengths of transmission line on various frequencies, 80 through 10 meters, should tell you immediately if your antenna analyzer is telling the truth. The right answer is across all frequencies. It should be a flat 4-to-1. Changing the length of transmission line that is lossless cannot change the standing wave ratio. and four dummy loads is by definition a 4-to-1. Or three dummy loads will be a 3-to-1, if you know what I mean. So, without spending a fortune, you can test the integrity of your antenna analyzer. And those spikes that you were describing to me earlier, they cannot be real. A simple magnetic loop like you described does not have the resources of making that many spikes as you tune a small amount of frequency. Something is wrong. Maybe the magnetic loop was giving you a feedback through the air into your antenna analyzer. Maybe if the antenna analyzer was held into the middle of the magnetic loop, it'll go crazy, if you know what I mean. So there's probably a way of finding out what's going on. But this dummy load resistor is the purest thing I can think of to test it without spending a fortune. And so let us know when you run that test what you find out. Over to you, Rich, K2LIW.
Okay, and the resistors, what do they do? They go from braid to semiconductor at each T connector?
I'm saying the best way to do it would be to get a hold of four 50-ohm, put two, three, four of those in parallel. The fact that there's a little length of those BNC connectors, the T connectors, in order to put them all together, doesn't matter. You're down at 80 meters, we're talking about 0.01 wavelength. Don't worry about it. But that will give you a pure 4-to-1 standing wave ratio, DC to light, so to speak. And if your antenna analyzer does not show that with various lengths of transmission line between that array of T connectors and the antenna analyzer, if it doesn't show you a flat 4-to-1 across that frequency region, then it's time to start asking questions about that antenna analyzer. Over to you, Rich, K2LIW.
And I think now, so you're saying the cells are the load.
You are buying or using 50-ohm dummy loads that come with a connector. The so-called dummy load could be a 30 dB attenuator where you use only the input connector, if you know what I mean. It doesn't matter what the output end is open circuited on a 30 dB attenuator. So high dB attenuators with a connector or dummy loads with a connector is what I recommend. I am not recommending you build your own dummy load out of 50-ohm resistors. You could do it, but now you're adding another variable that's going to complicate things. Beg, borrow, buy, get a hold of real terminated dummy loads that have a real connector on them before you connect them together with various T connectors. Over to you, Rich.
Got it now, and that's what I will do, and I will report back. Thanks a lot, Dick. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Yeah, I think you're going to find out that your antenna analyzer has been lying to you. Okay, it's time to go over to the science talk with Dr. Roy. We've got an interesting puzzle today, and I've got comments on that puzzle when he comes up to it. AC2, Golf Sierra, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. And as always, I like to mention the email address. If you have any topics you would like me to focus on, any questions you'd like answered, or if you want to refute something that I said, feel free. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And for things that I talk about, I do put up links on a page on the web. You just type in roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll take you to the page. Just to tie up a couple of topics there, in the first portion, I've been on the 10-meter Kings County Radio Club's net for about 4 years, maybe five, and initially I noticed the spurs that kind of alternated throughout a good portion of locally my 10 meters, where sometimes it would land right on 28.380, sometimes it would slide across it, and thankfully the last few years it disappeared, and I had to use a notch filter. I never really got to the source, but it was definitely a local source. And as far as W2BZ Rich, he's using an AA30-0, which is basically a 30 megahertz spec antenna analyzer that's not really shielded, I don't think. So there's a whole bunch of possible reasons to not quite get the right numbers at the time. But that's those 2 cents. Anyway, let me pause for a moment, and I will ask anyone if they just happen to have any questions for me before I start my little spiel.
Yes, stop before you this week.
Okay, I assume it's not about curling.
Nope, it's a genuine physics question.
Okay, Joe, let her rip. Yes, Joe, what's your question tonight?
Yeah, I need to get my paper ahead from this desk, so on, okay? Let's see. This is about hydrogen. Okay? The temperature out in space is something like 2.73 Kelvin, or minus 454.7 degrees. Hydrogen turns into a liquid at 423.17 degrees, minus, the other one's minus also, and turns it into a solid at 434.45 degrees, minus 434.45. If this is true, according to this information I found on the one web page, I think it was on Wikipedia or whatever, on hydrogen, how come if space is so incredibly cold, you don't find vast amounts of solid hydrogen floating around out there instead of being gaseous like it is? Is there an explanation for that?
Well, there's a combination of answers for that. The measurements that you gave for the freezing and the melting points of hydrogen are probably for one atmosphere of pressure, which is not the the pressure in outer space. So at a much lower pressure, the melting and the freezing point drop down precipitously. And also, the general density of hydrogen in most places in space is too low for it to join together as bonded solids or liquids. They're too amorphous. There's very few atoms per cubic centimeter to produce atomic bonding that maintains a liquid or a solid phase. But primarily, I think the problem is that these are numbers based on one atmosphere of pressure.
So with no pressure, how much does the temperature change for these readings? A lot? A little?
Lot. If you somehow drop the pressure to zero, I mean, you know, you're not going to because there's no absolute zero, there's no absolute vacuum. You are effectively going to have material boiling off into space and getting an equilibrium, and it would never become a liquid or a solid. There are some materials that require a great deal of pressure to even exist. There is something called metallic hydrogen, which can only be produced. It's not a matter of temperature, because we can get it really close to absolute zero. You have to put it in a diamond vise and provide a lot of pressure, squeezing the hydrogen down to smaller volume in order to have it turn into metallic hydrogen. So if you could make a zero pressure environment, everything would basically evaporate away into a gas.
Let me try this one, Royce. If in my laboratory I made a cubic centimeter of frozen solid hydrogen, and I take that cube and I take it way out in space and I deposit it somewhere and I leave it there for a while, out in space where there is a zero pressure, the surface of that solid cube of frozen hydrogen will sublime. When I come back a month later, I think there will be nothing there. Is that a possible way of looking at it? So if making it will not allow it to persist, it certainly on its own is not in the freeness of space ever going to form into a solid. AC2GS, K2RW.
Yes, Dick. It would sublime. I don't think it would take anything close to a month. I think it would sublime rather violently in the vacuum of space.
So therefore, in the vacuum of space, it doesn't want to be held together as a cloud, a liquid, or a solid. It wants to really be free.
Right. The only thing that keeps hydrogen together, thankfully for us, is the gravitational forces. If you pile enough of it around a certain location, the gravity well produced by all that mass will act as a force to keep it together. Otherwise, it will just wop away into the vacuum of space.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
They say the Voyager spacecraft, like Voyager 1, which is way out there.
By the way, you picket fencing a little bit, unfortunately. The vacuum of space is a pretty decent vacuum. It means that there's very few atoms anywhere near each other. So for all intents and purposes, they're isolated and all by themselves and far away from any other atom to form any kind of significant hydrogen bonding or hydroxyl bonding or all the other fun bonds. But it's not really covalent bonding that keeps much in the way of space stuff together. It's more just gravity.
Paul, tonight you may have to use Selden to get through. The propagation's not very good.
Better, right?
Much better.
Good, Dick.
So any other comments, answers, questions, side comments, what have you?
AC2LR, secondary question.
Okay, K recognize. I didn't quite catch the other person's call sign. I just wanted to know if Joe got an answer he could work with.
Not that I'm working with the stuff. I got an answer. Okay, and you pretty much answered it. Okay? Thank you.
Okay, Joe, I just wanted to be sure. The next person who checked in was K, AC2LR. What's your question for tonight, Kay?
I think earlier you said space is not a complete vacuum. I'm wondering if there is such a thing as a partial vacuum. What are your thoughts on that? ACT, LR?
Well, since there's no such thing as an absolute vacuum, because quantum mechanics would suggest that even in the absence of anything, virtual things will pop in and out of existence if left to time. So there's no such thing as a perfect vacuum, so almost pretty much by definition, all the vacuums that we can think of are partial vacuums. Same thing as an absolute 0 degree Kelvin. It's a theoretical construct that quantum mechanics doesn't really allow, because if you reached 0 degrees Kelvin, it would mean that all motion would stop and the quantum fluctuations that always persist wouldn't happen, and that would violate that principle.
That is fascinating. Thank you.
Welcome, Kay. There was a third person. I didn't really catch a call sign. If you want to try again. Okay, maybe I misunderstood. Anyway, once again, before I go into my usual spiel, if anyone has any particular questions that they would like to throw me, feel free.
By the way, a lot of people have a misunderstanding of absolute zero. If I had a single hydrogen atom, and I bring it down to absolute zero in temperature, or millikelvin, or microkelvin, or nanokelvin, something very, very close to absolute zero, that means at that low temperature it has very little translation. As a total molecule, it is not translating. But that electron is still going around that proton exactly the way it did when it was at room temperature. For people who make the mistake of thinking at absolute zero, the electron stops going around the proton. If it did, it wouldn't be hydrogen anymore. That's an opinion. Over to you, Roy, K2LR.
Okay, Dick. As I said before, absolute zero is a theoretical construct. I think most physicists would say that if quantum mechanics really exists, it's impossible to bring anything to absolute zero. You can bring them very, very close, but you can't reach that point. Electrons really don't, per se, orbit a nucleus. This goes back to, unfortunately, the Bohr atom, which was a very nice demonstration, illustration that allowed people to kind of think about stuff. But electrons, unfortunately, because the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, you cannot predict their momentum and their energy level simultaneously. You can't place them in space and time accurately. So they kind of smear as a probability function across a certain volume of space around the nucleus. So even though we talk about spin, it's not really orbital mechanics spin, because it would violate relativity. It would travel faster than the speed of light. It has more to do with the rotation of a wave function's polarization angle, which, don't worry about that. It's just not spin. What we call quantum spin is not mechanical spin. So if you're thinking about electrons orbiting a nucleus like our planet orbits the sun, it doesn't really do things like that.
Most of the molecules, the individual lows of electrons do some very complicated things, but the simplest possible molecule, a hydrogen atom at the base level of excitation. If I analyze that electron as in a fairly simple circular orbit going around that proton, aren't I somewhat close to what's really happening on that particular molecule?
Now, by accident you are, because by accident the square of the wave equation that defines the lowest level of an electron is a very spherical shell-like construct, not necessarily a elliptical or a circular, but more of a spherical. Again, you can't tell where an electron is in location and what its velocity is simultaneously. You can either calculate its velocity or its location, but never both, because of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So it exists someplace as a probability wave in a shell-like form around the nucleus. Now, you get into a lot of trouble, though, if you move up to the next orbital, which is a P orbital, which looks like a dumbbell. Dumbbells, there's no way that you could force a dumbbell to look anything like an orbital mechanic.
Okay, if I go back to that base level hydrogen atom, which is now a spherical shell in its location around that proton, and if I now put it in a very strong magnetic field, don't I end up with a somewhat linear plane of orbit of that electron around that proton? K2RIW.
You can probably force some precession going on with the electron probability, but I don't think you could constrict it to anything that would be anything close to orbital mechanics.
Are you saying the magnetic field will have very little effect on that electron, even if the magnetic field is quite strong?
I think it would have an effect, but I don't think it would have a sufficient effect to narrow the range as much as people would want in order to kind of conceive of it as anything like a orbital mechanics. Ultimately, in orbital mechanics, you want to shrink it down to, say, if it means anything, the radius of an electron orbiting around an atom. The problem is that very likely electrons are dimensionless point charges. They don't have a diameter. So if you needed to narrow the sphere to a pointless non-dimensional structure, the laws of physics break down at that point.
If I have a container of high density helium, hydrogen, and if I have another container of liquid hydrogen, and I have a third container of solid hydrogen, cryogenically cooled, at a reasonable pressure, do any of those have magnetic properties that can be defined?
Yes. If you solidified hydrogen, it has a single unpaired electron. Well, helium would work like that. Well, I don't know. I got to take all these things back. The problem with hydrogen is that it's reactive. So most likely, if you put it anywhere near other hydrogen, it would create covalent bonding. So you'd have paired electrons, and so you wouldn't have anything that would have a net magnetic moment.
Okay. How about helium? Helium in the liquid state or the solid state? Does it have magnetic properties?
No. For the most part, no, because most of magnetic moments come from valence shells. So once again, helium has two electrons. They fill up the 1s orbital. One goes clockwise or counterclockwise or plus, the other one minus, however the notation you want to be. So the net value of the dipole moment is zero. There is a very, very slight magnetic moment to helium only because it has a neutron. And although neutrons have a net zero charge, they are not consistently zero charge. There are positive aspects to it and negative aspects. So a helium atom will have a slight dipole moment, but much weaker than from valence electrons, purely from the magnetic dipole moment of the neutron.
Is there any gaseous element in any state, gas, liquid, or solid, which has significant magnetic properties? Is there any gaseous element with magnetic properties?
I would assume so. I mean, they don't really demonstrate that as a gas or even as a liquid. You pretty much what we consider, you know, magnetic qualities are more due to solids aligning and kind of locking down in certain ways. But I would imagine gases, a lot of different nuclei and electron clouds of gases certainly can have dipole moments. They won't have a measurable, number of Teslas. You can't magnetize a gas cloud, but if it has an unpaired electron, you probably are able to do it to one degree or another.
Of all the elements in the periodic table, and it's close to 100 of them, what percentage of those elements have significant magnetic properties? Is that a rare phenomenon, or would you, Roy?
Well, yeah, I think a year ago I kind of went into the fact that we kind of generalize magnetism, which is reasonable. But usually when most people talk about magnetism, they're really talking about ferromagnetism. Ferromagnetism is a very, very narrow definition. It means that not only does the material align by a external magnetic field, but when you release it from the external magnetic field, it kind of has inertia. It gets stuck. And so you could take a piece of iron, you could take a piece of nickel, you could take a piece of cobalt, you can expose it to, say, an electromagnet or a strong magnetic field, turn the electromagnet off, and the piece of nickel will still have magnetic qualities. That's ferromagnetism. There's also paramagnetism, in which there's no memory. The grains align themselves, but as soon as you lose the external magnetic field, they randomize. There's diamagnetic, which is a repulsive opposing force. There's even things called anti-ferromagnetism, and there's ferrimagnetism. There's a lot of different magnetisms. So generally speaking, almost every element has either rarely ferromagnetic, but very often has a degree of paramagnetic qualities or diamagnetic qualities.
It seems like there's a very small number of elements in the periodic table that have ferromagnetic properties, like only a few percent of them.
Yes, I would agree. Basically, it's iron, it's nickel, it's cobalt, and there's one other material that really, its Curie point, where it loses the ferromagnetism, is at room temperature. So if you get it out in the cold during the winter, it demonstrates ferromagnetism, but if you bring it inside, it loses it. I'm blocking on that element. But there's very few elements, unfortunately, that are ferromagnetic, because it requires something even more than an unpaired electron. It depends upon very curious state in the structure that lets it kind of lock in and have an inertia to changing its magnetic moment after it's established by an external field.
How about the element neodymium? Does pure neodymium have significant ferromagnetism, or is it true only when it's made into a particular compound? Over to you, Roy.
Unfortunately, neodymium is would be a rotten magnet. I don't even know if it's paramagnetic. For all I know, I looked it up, and unfortunately, I forgot. It might very well be diamagnetic in its pure state. It is only as a very complex component with boron and iron, iron being the important part, but the others are important as well, where these three metal nuclei line up in a very interesting crystal lattice that reinforces iron's ferromagnetism and increases the amount of magnetic quality per gram, per milligram, per weight that neodymium, boron, iron magnets possess. But if you had a lump of neodymium, you couldn't pick it up with a magnet.
30 years ago, a strong magnet was alnico, aluminum, nickel, cobalt. Was that compound predicted before it was built, its magnetic properties? Nowadays, neodymium, iron, cobalt, or iron, boron, makes a very strong magnet. Was that predicted ahead of time, or was that discovered? And the third question is there a possibility that some other combination of the elements will make a super magnet, maybe even better than a neodymium compound magnet? Over to you, Roy. K2R, is it?
NWS2N.
Okay, Paul recognized. Let me just answer the question, and then I'll give it over to Paul. Alnico is aluminum nickel cobalt. It was found, my understanding, experimentally. The physics involved in calculating why the heck something should be ferromagnetic is really complicated. So it's more a factor of guys just going to the lab and trying different alloys and testing things. Now, there is another alloy that's almost as good as neodymium, samarium cobalt. I'm sure you've seen samarium cobalt magnets. They have almost as good quality as neodymium, but samarium is a lot more expensive than the small amount of neodymium you need for a neodymium. So samarium cobalt was very popular before neodymium came in. And you never know, some material scientist might come up with a new alloy, a new metamaterial, that has even better qualities as a ferromagnetic material. Wes recognized. I just want to know if Dick has anything to reply or he wants me to go to Paul first.
Is there any relationship between compounds that make a good magnet and compounds that make a good superconductor? Or are they thoroughly unrelated? The reason I'm asking that is because a superconductor usually has a level of magnetic field or a temperature beyond which it's no longer superconductive. Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, they're not terribly related. In matter of fact, there are two classes of superconducting material. There's class one, which are the older ones, which have a much lower temperature where they become superconducting, and there are class two superconductors that they're trying to get it closer and closer to room temperature. They haven't gotten anywhere near it, but it has superconducting abilities at far higher temperatures. The type two lets magnetic fields actually leak through flaws in its structure, whereas a type 1 will block all magnetic fields going through superconducting material. But, superconducting materials don't make good magnets, and good magnets usually don't make good superconducting material.
Thank you.
Welcome. Paul, you wanted to say something?
Yes, Roy, I just wanted to go back a couple of minutes when we were talking about the different possible elements that might create a magnetic field. And I know we have hydrogen turning into a liquid, and they believe it turns into a metal.
inside of Jupiter. You know, the pressure is so great, and they think that that's where this ridiculous magnetic field that Jupiter has, which is extremely powerful. I mean, it goes out millions of miles away from the planet. It comes from this hydrogen that's turned into a metal, and that's creating an electrical field. And